Hello and welcome to A Week in the News, a podcast from the Journal and the Chronicle, discussing all the best topics that have been in the paper this week. I'm your host, Chris Scott, the social media editor for the two papers, and this week I'm joined by Sophie Doughty, our crime reporter, Sophie Biddle from the EDP in Norwich, Rhiann Lubin from The Mirror, and Mikey Reynolds from The Daily Record. Hello to all.
Hello.
Hiya.
Okay, so guys, the biggest story in the papers this week was undoubtedly Darren Robson, the homeless man who tragically burned to death. This week, Sophie, you covered this topic for the papers this week. Can you kind of give us a little bit of background about what happened?
Yeah, I mean, this was probably, you know, one of the really really shocking story that we covered this week. For me personally, I went out after hearing that a body had been found in Whitley Bay. I actually grew up around North Shields and Whitley Bay, and it's quite, I mean, when you work for your local paper and when you do stories that are close to home, they always seem a little bit more real to you. And, you know, there's something about seeing forensics and police out on the streets that you knew from when you were young that, you know, sort of really brings it home to you. I was quite lucky to quickly find Darren Robson, the man that's died's best friend. And what it turned out, well, what appears to have happened is that he lit a fire to keep warm. He's sleeping on the streets, lit a fire to keep warm. And, I mean, we're still waiting for the police to conclude investigations for inquests and things, but it looks like that might have been what killed him, is the fact that, you know, he'd been sleeping in this bin store and he'd, you know, it was a cold night, he'd asked his friend for some help, he couldn't help him, and he'd lit this fire.
Yeah, he actually turned away for police to stay that night,
yeah,
didn't he?
I think one of the things that is really tragic about this is the only person that Darren had to go to for help was his friend Chris, who himself is living in supported housing. He'd also been homeless. He also had problems as well. And he turned him away, and then when he had nowhere to go, he went to, and he seems to have lit this fire. The reaction to the story has actually been so strong, I think, because we quite a lot of the time think of homelessness as a, until about probably 10 years ago, I always thought of it as a problem in places like London. You didn't see homeless people sleeping on the streets. Over recent years, you've seen it in the city centre, but as you know, it was still really shocking to think, you know, behind, you know, these shops in Whitley Bay, there's people sleeping there. You know, they've got nowhere to go, and this death has been a result of that.
It's a tragic story as well, because you wrote a great piece about the last 10 years of his life, and in 2004. He gave an interview to us and basically said he turned his life around. He'd beat this battle with alcohol addiction.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it really tragic is, you know, a lot of the time people that we have featured before in the paper, you know, they come back up in different circumstances, and Darren was one of these people. He'd actually been working as like a mentor and helping other alcoholics, having beaten his addiction himself, and you know, but it just, his life sort of spiraled downwards again, and I think it sort of shows that, you know, this could be anyone. Mm-hmm. It only takes a few bits of bad luck. I've covered stories before where really successful people, you know, with their own businesses, lovely home and family, you know, one thing goes wrong, they lose their job or mm-hmm. they lose their wife, and they end up, you know, living in a sort of community that they wouldn't normally live in, and then, you know, alcohol or drugs comes in, and it's like a downward spiral. And for Darren, it went down so far to the point where his only way to keep warm was to light a fire, which seems to have killed him.
Yeah, what really brought this home to me was in your piece where you quote Darren from 2004, and to quote him, he says, "I'm living proof that you can change. I'll never go back to how I was. It's scary when I look back. I haven't been where I've been, and I don't ever want to go back there again." And that really brought it home, and it's such a tragic loss of life.
Yeah, it's absolutely tragic, that. And the fact that, you know, people often say, well, you know, people have to want to change their life. And, he did. He obviously wanted to change. He wanted to help others. His experience was help others. I've since been in contact with a lady who he has helped, and we're going to do a story with her. And she says she wouldn't have been here today if it wasn't for him. But, you know, there could have been so many points in his life where, you know, it could have been stopped from him ending up in this situation. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of debate online since we did the story about what's actually there for the homeless in 2014. Mm. Is it necessary that anyone should be homeless? And, you know, it's a big problem. And I mean, I wouldn't want to be the one to find a solution for it. But you have to think, you know, in Whitley Bay in 2014, should people be dying because they've lit fires to keep warm? And I think, you know, everyone would agree that shouldn't be the situation.
Yeah, well, let's open this up to the group then. Mikey, we ran a story last night that caused a lot of debate online as well. Some beggars, and we must be clear to distinguish between beggars and the homeless, or some beggars in the city centre are earning up to £200 a day. And so local charities are saying, stop giving money, just give food, give a hot drink, but don't give money because it's going to fuel addiction and stuff like that. You know, is there anything else that the city council can do, or just us as general citizens, that we can do to help these people?
I think we are all responsible, like, as a society. We're responsible if somebody's homeless. No matter what circumstances have caused them to be there, we've got a duty to help them, I think, in whatever way we can. And when I first read the piece, I found myself, I disagreed with the headline before I read the piece, because I read, don't give beggars money. And I thought, well, most people have a reason for asking for money. But then when I read into it, I did agree with it, because there is, as you say, a distinction between being homeless and being a beggar. I think it's probably a lot more helpful if you give somebody a cup of tea or a sandwich or something, rather than just dropping 10p into their lap just as a token gesture. So I think that doesn't go a long way to help. But I think the council could help more, and obviously they're massively restricted by budget, so even if you go above that to national government, there should be more done, I think, to just stop people being homeless, because the UK is one of the world's most developed countries, and it's astounding still that there's people sleeping on the streets and lighting fires to stay warm, or families having to use food banks still in a country like the UK. I think there must be a way that we can build more centres, or even convert empty buildings into some sort of sleeping centre for homeless people, something like that, that would just give people a place to go and stop people like Darren having to light fires in the street and then end up losing their life over it.
It's astounding as well, because both Sophie and Mikey have just said that it's sad in this day and age that people are still homeless. Not only are people still homeless, we ran a story earlier this month that homeless charity Shelter have spoken to 2,000 people in the Northeast in the last year on the brink of homelessness, which is an increase of 28% since 2012. Now, Rhiann, surely them figures speak for themselves, that not enough's being done and this has got to change.
Yeah, I think there's also a negative stigma towards them as well, and people don't really want to understand. Like, people will say they got themselves into that situation, they can get themselves out of it, or people have to be able to want to help, like they want to change themselves. And I don't think there's enough knowledge there on our part. We don't really understand, because it's never happened to us, so do you really care? And like, how many times have you walked past somebody and never done anything? I think it's really difficult to know what to do, because you don't want to fuel any addictions, but we just don't know. I don't think there's anything out there at the moment that...
This is where I've got a problem with it, because you have three super kind ladies from Wall's End who are appalled by the Darren Robson case, and they've gone out this week and they've been handing out sleeping bags, gloves, soup. Sophie, should this be left to just individuals themselves, or as we've talked about, I think we all agree, it should be more of a council responsibility, shouldn't it?
I think perhaps it should be more of a council responsibility in order to tackle the situation as a whole. But as Mikey said, it's almost the responsibility of, you know, the population. I mean, it is outstanding that we can walk past people and just ignore the fact that they are cold, they're on the streets, they're hungry. It's amazing that in our culture we can sort of walk past them, and it's so integrated into our culture that they will be there. So I think on some levels, on a sort of human level, we perhaps should do more to tackle this problem by giving out sort of sleeping bags or, you know, cups of soup. But at the same time, that's not tackling the roots of the problem. I think perhaps that's where the council has the majority of the responsibility to guide these people to know where they can go. I'm sure that a lot of people, they just, when they're out in the streets, they don't know where to go. They don't know where the direction is, you know, to get some help. So perhaps that's where the council can help in that way, by contacting them and going out onto the streets themselves to point them in the right direction.
Just on the point of the council, I mean, I don't know Darren's particular situation, but I mean, I think councils do have a statutory responsibility to house homeless people. But there are lots of people that they don't want to be housed. For example, if you're an alcoholic that doesn't want to stop drinking, and you know, you're offered a space in a hostel where you can't drink, you might choose to live on the streets. And I think what's amazing about what these women from War's End did is they did something very practical. I mean, you know, we know the mess this country's in financially and things, and we know that there's a, you know, certain pots of money put into different areas, and there are certain people that don't fit into those pockets. You know, I've done stories about people that are living on the streets because they can't be housed, because they're dangerous, a hostel won't take... You know, if you're a hostel with a load of residents, why should you put a dangerous criminal in there? You know, it's not fair on the other residents. But I think what's great about what the Women in War's End did was it was something very, very practical. They weren't going to give them money that might feed any addiction. They just thought, you know, how much does a blanket cost? Everyone's got an old blanket. How much does a cup of tea cost? And what a lot of people commented on the Darren Robson story online was, the next time I pass someone homeless, I'm going to buy them a cup of tea from Greggs, which is, what, 90 pence. And, you know, it's something practical, and it's something that, you know, where, you know, as individuals, we can't solve all the problems in society, but at that moment we can buy someone a cup of tea, and I think that, you know, that's commendable, and these women have gone out and just done what they can. So I know it doesn't solve the root cause of the problem, but it helps the immediate problem.
And I think in terms of helping people, because I've read a lot of stories interviewing homeless people, and what they often say is that the thing that hurts them the most is that people just ignore them and pretend they're not there, and or like Sophie said, just they become part of the environment. They're the same as a street lamp or a bin on the corner. They're just expected to be there. So I think like what the women from Wall's End did is a good thing, a very good thing, because it means that people are beginning to recognise homeless people and actually interact with them and not just look past them, pretend they're not there and just completely ignore them.
It's an issue that I'm sure is going to be going on and on for a while now, and hopefully we'll get some solutions from, if not the councils, then people working with charities, and it's something that I'm sure Sophie will be looking into over the next few weeks. Another issue that was in the paper this week was the Northumberland Football Association have cut the ties with the Vice President, or the former Vice President, John Cummings, for saying, and I quote, "A woman's place is in the kitchen, not on the football field." Now, talking about problems in society, this is still a massive issue, and I think I'm going to shut up for a bit now and let the three women in the room take this on, because I haven't got the same experience as you guys. Can you just talk about any, you know, casual sexism that you guys come across in the workplace? Hopefully not the workplace, but in, you know, out on the street or just in your general lives.
I actually personally think sexism's starting to come full circle, and we had a brief period where women were seen as equal, and some men, not all men, recently become a little bit threatened by that. And when they see women getting to certain levels in their career and things, that they almost want to feminise women a bit more. I mean, in my early days of journalism in the newsroom, to get on as a woman, you just had to try and be a bit blokey and be as hard as the men. You didn't want to be girly. You wanted to, you know, do the jobs as risky as the male reporters did. You wanted to be as harsh on the news desk as you were, and you know, you wanted to be one of the lads, and that's how you sort of got accepted. And if you were good at your job and did that, you know, there was no distinction at all. I think in the wider world, there's a bit, you know, things like in football, for example, if a female referee, or, you know, anyone in sport is female and doing as well as the men, there will be some men that don't like that and think, oh, we need to batter down a bit. And some women have become more girly. Some women have become more girly off the back of that and sort of played up on being a woman, and because they've had to. But that doesn't help the situation either. It's I don't know what the solution is, but you know, there has to be a way to be a woman, be a successful woman in the field that you want to be, even if it's male. And
absolutely. I think also nowadays the problem isn't so black and white. I think the comments are very outdated. I think, you know, people joke about women being in the kitchen, and you know, in context it's meant to be a joke, but in actual fact it shows something a bit deeper running through the sexism row. But I think nowadays it isn't so sort of black and white. You do get women in the sort of higher positions in the workplace, but I also think that generally it's just not about men and women, it's about all types of people who aren't being able to get into the higher levels of the workplace. I mean, you know, it's not just so simple as sort of men versus women. I mean, you can broaden the argument out to sort of people from, you know, public schools or private schools or people from comprehensives not sort of getting as high as, you know, as other people. So it's a debate which I think is kind of old-fashioned in a way. But in terms of the general sort of sexism, I don't come across it, I have to say, that often in the, you know, in the streets. I think a few years back there used to be a lot of wolf whistling and things, you know, from groups of men. And in my experience, it's just been on a kind of Saturday night that you experience it most.
I wish I had the same experience, but I don't. Like, walking to work pretty much every day along Jesmond Road, there's a lot of, like, lorries and white vans that come down with, literally, they all, not all of them, but they beep the guys, like, just kind of make lewd gestures. And
I don't think that's a new thing. I think that all my life, I think that's gone on. It's when it starts getting, like, offensive and when it starts getting a bit antagonistic if you don't reply. I think that's when it becomes an issue. I don't, you know, I think men whistling at women is part of life and always has been, and I don't find it particularly worrying or offensive. It's, like you say, comments that would someone come up to you and say that to your face? Would they come up to you and say that to your face if you're, you know, with someone else?
I know, but sorry, just to jump in there, it's amazing. Like, I find, as a man looking in on this issue, that it's what's accepted by women. Like what you said, it's just a part of life and there's nothing you can do. It shouldn't be. And whether this is education in schools, whether this is just a society going, no, that's it. It shouldn't be an accepted part of life.
I think the problem is there's a fine line between banter and what's offensive.
But do you not think banter's a word used all the time? It's, mm-hmm. Oh, it's only a bit of banter. It's just, you get away with a lot.
No, but I think that's the problem. I think because there's an underlying undertone of control and sexism, what would have a few years ago been seen as banter and women would take as banter, it becomes a bit more dangerous and it's difficult, you know, because I'm not offended if someone whistles at me in the street. I am offended if they say something lewd, and I think it's about what you're comfortable with. If you're making someone feel uncomfortable, then it's wrong. And
it is surprising how much alcohol becomes a fuel for that kind of behaviour. I mean, it's ludicrous, and it's not just verbal either.
Yeah, it's, you know, in bars and in town as well. I think, you know, we've discussed this before, where it's suddenly okay to grab a woman in a bar because you're in a bar and you're in a crowded space. Would you grab a woman in Phoenix? No, you wouldn't. Even if it was crowded, you know, Christmas shopping on a Saturday, you would not expect to be grabbed whilst doing your Christmas shopping in a crowded space. In a bar, it's suddenly acceptable, and you know, it's just. But I think you're right. You know, women do sort of put up with it, and it becomes part of a night out. And you don't want to ruin your night out by, you know, saying something. You don't want to ruin your night out by telling a bouncer, and you think you might not be taken seriously. But you know, you wouldn't. Even in the street, someone to grab
you. If it's ever happened to me, I've told a bouncer and got the guy kicked out.
Good on you.
Because I just don't see why it should be one set of rules outside a club and another set inside.
Yeah. And if we saw a bloke with fancy and started grabbing him, I'd love to see what his reaction was.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely objectifying.
Right. All right, well, so let's move on from that issue, because I'm sure we could talk about that for an hour. okay, East Coast Trains. We're recording this on Thursday, by the way, so I have to say it was today announced that Virgin Trains and Stagecoach have won the rights for the East Coast mainland route, and so they've promised to invest £140 million over the next 8 years and will pay the government £3.3 billion for that contract. This is despite East Coast paying the government £235 million back last year, which is the final year that it'll be in public hands, which is 12% up on the previous year. A lot of unions have said this proves that this privatisation is politically motivated, which was, I have to say, dismissed by the Islington MP, Graham Morris. But Mikey, if it's not politically motivated, what's behind this privatisation?
I think it's just a move. Like, the railways are, for the most part, privatised now. East Coast is pretty much the only public rail franchise. I think it's just to go along with the culture of privatisation is why they've done it, more than for any operating reason or financial reason, because East Coast was a successful franchise and it was a line that runs without any real problems. Obviously there's delays here and there, but compared to other main lines in the country, it runs surprisingly well, and as far as I'm aware, tons of profit, which is rare for a rail franchise. So I think it has to be politically motivated, because as a government run train company, East Coast was doing a great job. I think if you polled people, they would say the same thing. I think it's just that there's more money in it for the government. There's $3.3 billion worth it if they give it to a private company. But the other issue with it is Virgin, especially, have run the West Coast main line for years and it's not been the most successful of lines. I think there had to be a choice between keeping a company that was public and was successful and giving it to a private company, which, yes, you'd get more money from, but you're risking the service and you're taking it out of public hands, meaning it's less open. I think that's where the problem is, and that's why I think it's politically motivated. Mm. It's not in the interests of the public, I don't think, because most people, I don't think, would want it to change.
I think the public, as long as they're getting a reliable train service and a reasonably priced one, don't really care who runs it. There was, you know, a few years back, when the railways were in a massive mess. Like when I was at university, like I went to university at Warwick, and I was coming back up here, and they, you know, you couldn't guarantee you were going to get back up. It was just after when all the speed restrictions had come in off the back of the train crashes and things. And everyone said then, oh well, this is what happened when you let the private sector take over the railways. But you know, if a private company is going to run it well and it's going to, you know, be reliable and affordable, I think the public will just take, you know, a good train service, and which is, I think things have got better as well.
I think the public are going to see the $140 million investment within the train line itself. They're going to see that as a good thing, aren't they?
I expect so, but I would say probably, I understand your point that the public just want a good and reliable train service. But if it is being privatised, I mean, who's keeping checks on it? Who's keeping checks on this train service? I mean, surely if it was in the hands of the government, you know, it would be regulated more. And I think from past experience, I don't find the train services so reliable. I've been delayed many times, so I wouldn't say that chucking money at the services and kind of privatising them, in my view, it hasn't actually helped the situation at all.
So, Rhiann, you on the train line up and down the country quite a lot. Any opinions on East Coast going private?
Well, I've only ever used it since I've come up here. I've never been up here for more than a couple of months, but it seemed pretty good. I mean, I used to use Virgin for when I travelled between Birmingham and London, and it, on the whole, it was pretty good, and there weren't many, I didn't find there were many delays. So I actually thought East Coast were pretty good when I used them as well. So
I suppose it's tricky if you're forced to commute by train and you have to do the same route every day and there's only one operator, you're stuck and you can't really, like, be a customer and let your money do the talking, which is, you know, when Sophie was saying about, well, if it's not regulated, how we're going to have any say. It's, I think for me, it's sort of like, if I looked at the prices and looked how reliable it was, if I was deciding, well, shall I go away for the weekend by train? Well, no, it costs too much and it's not reliable. I'll take my money elsewhere. But I think it's different if you're commuting and you're stuck with the operator.
Yeah. All right, well, we've took on three quite heavy subjects there. So let's finish with something light before we move on to our regular feature, Babbling On. It's Black Friday tomorrow, which... Allegedly, as Sophie says. Well, we'll move on to that in a second. But from living in America previously, Black Friday was a massive deal. You'd go to Thanksgiving, which is today as we're recording. You'd go have a big meal, and then you'd just wait around. You would literally wait around, maybe have a nap after the meal, watch some football, NFL, that is. And you would wait until midnight. You would drive to the mall, you'd drive to the outlet, and you'd wait until the shops opened at midnight, and you would be shopping until 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, getting all their bargains with 70, 80% off a lot of merchandise. There was always a massive queue outside the Sony store, I always remember. But now, I've never seen Black Friday in the UK before, but somehow this year it's become a thing.
The first time I heard of it was last year, and I'd never heard of it before, and I think it's just a one Americanism too far, to be honest. You know, we've got Christmas is coming, and I think a big one of the things I love the most about Christmas is, you know, Christmas shopping, spreading it over Christmas, going out, seeing FedEx window, you know, hearing the Christmas music, maybe having a few drinks afterwards. We don't need, you know, these sales and everyone fighting over stuff. Black Friday, you know, it doesn't, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't exist yet. It's a marketing tool. It's trying to get everyone to spend the money as quickly as possible. And, you know, there's sales after Christmas. Like, don't be so tight. Just enjoy shopping. And then there'll be some sales after Christmas if you really want to go to the Boxing Day sales. And if you're a size 0 or a size 22, you might find something. But, you know, I just don't see the point of it, to be honest.
Does anyone think this is a good idea, Black Friday?
I just don't think people do it this... I leave mine till like 2 days before. I don't have time to do it now. I'm not really thinking about it yet. I was quite alarmed to discover Christmas is a month away, pretty much exactly. But I'd never heard of this before either, nor had I heard of Cyber Monday, which I think is that the biggest day online happening. People can online shop all the time. I don't.
Yeah, it's just online shopping is lazy as well at Christmas. So you just go out and buy. Yeah,
it's a bit get involved with the crowds. Okay, so a week in the news has officially declared Black Friday does not exist in the United Kingdom. Okay, so moving on to our regular feature, Babbling On, which is stuff that you're going to be talking about to your friends and family in the pub this weekend. Mikey, what's your babble this week?
This weekend, me and my friends will mostly be talking about the NFL. We're all pretty big football, American football fans. And Thanksgiving weekend's always massive in the NFL. It's just before the playoffs. So things are starting to take shape. Teams are getting knocked out. Teams are starting to look like they could be on their way to the Super Bowl. And just starting from tonight, there's games on pretty much every night. And there's just loads of football to watch. So that'll be my weekend pretty much sewn up.
Nice. Well, we've said Black Friday isn't a thing, and I'm going to say American football isn't a thing as well. Rhianne?
I'm not sure how interested my friends are going to be when I talk about this, but I'm a bit of a science fiction nerd, so I'm going to see War of the Worlds at the Metro Arena on Wednesday, I think. I'm doing a review, and I'm really excited to see that.
Awesome. Is Tom Cruise there?
He's not.
Oh, it's a shame.
But it's a musical, so that's going to be interesting. But yeah, I'm excited for that.
What are the Wales musical? Oh, you'll have to tell us what it's like.
I will.
Read that in the paper definitely next week. Sophie, do you want to go first?
Well, again, my friends will probably be bored of me talking about this, but Take That's new album comes out on Monday. And having listened to all the other albums in the car every morning on my way to work, I'm bored of them now. I need something, well, you can never get bored of Take That, but I need something new to listen to. Their first album is a three-piece. I'm just very excited. Got tickets to them at the arena in May, so...
Will you be buying it on Cyber Monday?
I'll be buying it from a shop on Cyber Monday.
Okay. All right, Sophie, and finally, what's your babble on this week?
Mine is an American podcast called Serial.
Oh, you've got mine. Oh. Okay, go on.
I've just been trying to get everybody, including my boyfriend, to listen to it. Basically, I heard about it from another friend, so I think it seems to be spreading by word of mouth. But it's very interesting,
yes,
and
it
once
is.
You watch or listen to the first episode, well, you can't stop.
Shall we talk about what it actually is? Because we're promoting another podcast on the podcast, kind of like within the podcast. It's kind of like Inception now. But basically, it's a murder mystery, isn't it? It's about a guy who went away. He's gone away for. He's been in jail for the last 15 years. He committed a murder on his ex girlfriend. Apparently, in 1999, but there's a lot of doubts, and you don't know from 1 week to the next what the next development's going to be.
Right.
And it's a live thing; it's running week by week. So even the people who are doing it don't know where this story's going to end. And it's just been announced that there's going to be a second series, and I'm going crazy over it because I love this podcast. And I hate Thanksgiving because there's no episode this week because of it, because it comes out on a Thursday.
Yeah.
I know. So I'm in serious withdrawal symptoms at the moment.
Okay. I'm still on episode 3, so I'm really
I'm on episode 9. I divulged them all. Yeah, I love them very, very much. Okay, well, I'd just like to thank you all for coming this week. I think that was a really, really good chat. And I'd just like to thank all the listeners for listening. That's A Week in the News.